next him.
Is that a warning? I ask.
Advice, rather.
He glances at Clearastes on the horse next to Roan's.
It seems you heed the wrong men.
I know how to handle Atalantia.
That would make you the first.
I lean past Atlas and press a DNA scanner on the side of the chariot. There's a thrum as the reinforced pulse shield flickers into place, distorting the world around and encasing the entirety of the passenger compartment with enough shielding to take a direct hit from a Pelum missile. Atlas chuckles.
A promising start.
Trumpets signal the beginning of the triumph. A blind white girl walks ahead of my chariot with a flaming torch. With an old white guiding her, she finds her way to the crimson curtain that hides us from the crowd. She pushes the torch into the wall, flames lick upward. When they have consumed all but the topmost remnants of the curtain, my charioteer snaps the reins, and the chariot rolls forward. We are swallowed by noise. A street cleared of rubble bisects a sea of humanity for 4 kilometers, until the street bends to the right. Millions roar on the ground, on the rooftops. Trumpets blast, bells clatter on horses. The sound washes over me as we ride forward. An honor guard lines the parade route, not Votum or Ash Legions. I feel the chill of the past. The Praetorians have returned. Thousands of purple and black clad men and women stand with their rifles shouldered. I glance back at Roan. He smiles and bellows,
Praetorians! Ad Lusum! Loon! Invictus!
They have returned from their disbandment by the thousands. The Fear Knight's voice is barely a whisper.
Poor choice, young man. Poor choice.
I miss the desert. It was simpler there. The route is 12 kilometers long, exactly the length of Selenius's first triumph on the Via Triumphia from Hyperion to the Citadel. After 10 minutes, I am exhausted from sensory overload. Flowers cascade, children rush from the crowd to bedeck the honored with floral wreaths of mountain flowers. The battle cry of the Lightbringer echoes through the city, verse after drunken verse. Military ships hover with snipers to cover the rooftops for signs of terrorists or agitators. Despite the best efforts of society forces to round up all the enemy at the spaceport, it's inevitable that thousands more will have melted into the city. A triumph in this climate is as good as a death sentence. And we all remember Darrow's fated day. But how could I refuse Atalantia? Of course there are snipers. Shots slam into the pulse shield over us and send response teams swarming over rooftops. I almost pity the shooters. With each shot I wonder if it is Darrow's men or Atalantia's or someone else's. Who knows? The procession carries through the heart of the city and comes to a halt at the mound of Votum. The statue of Helios still lies fallow in the sea. High upon the steps of the great palace, Atalantia waits, surrounded by the 200 heads of the prominent remaining houses. The brooding Falth killers, vile Asmodeus au Carthiae, and Cicero au Votum are all there. The Carthii tap their feet in resentment, as if they have better things to do. The Votum beam at me. I saved their city from extermination. And now they see a chance to escape from under Atalantia's thumb.
Remember, you are but a mortal, Atlas whispers into my ear.
I hop down from the chariot.
As are we all.
He frowns as I ascend the steps toward Atalantia. Ajax looms behind her amongst her officers and Olympic knights. She smiles in lovely fashion. Behind that smile is so much malice. She wonders, just as the crowd and the Praetorians and the soldiers wonder, when we come face to face, will I kneel? When I reach the top of the stairs, the crowd goes silent. Atalantia is in pure white. Her shoulder spikes are gold, her necklace, that dreadful pet Hypatia, and two ornate gauntlets of gold cover either hand. Her gold razor is at her side, but I know she looks at the broken sling blade I wear on my right hip. It is the envy of all the legions.
"Darling, I do believe you took me far too literally," she says with a sexual sigh, as she looks at the left half of my face. "I said, earn a scar, not become one."
I left room for one more.
"From boy to man, and all it took was a little friction," she replies. "If I knew it was that easy, I could have made a man of you myself."
She winks and draws her razor. "Shall we make it formal?" I can practically hear the tension coiling in the parade behind me. I expected my stomach to ravel into knots, but I feel impossibly calm.
"All men are not created equal."
She draws the razor along the right side of my cheekbone, cutting deeper than necessary to give me my peerless scar.
"So you have proven."
She does not return her razor to her hip, but watches my blood run along its edge. Ajax stares a hole through my head from amongst her officers.
"Look how they fawn over you," she whispers of the crowd. 10 years you abandoned them, and now they drool like inebriated sheep. Disgusting."
She tilts her head at me.
"It's funny, isn't it, how some questions continue to be asked, even though they've been answered in every age? My favourite is one you're probably dwelling on right now. Is it better to be feared or loved?"
We both know the answer to that. Her teeth flash as she glances at Atlas several steps beneath me.
"Don't we just?"
"I imagine it will be a sniper," I ask.
"Oh, you did not fence half so well as a child. It's a dreadful red, pulled from the depths of their unholy hoard. I thought about doing it myself," she replies. "But we've seen the value of martyrs, haven't we? And to think the heir had returned, only for his head to disappear with the flash of a distant muzzle."
She leans forward.
"Good thing he has others to carry the flame in his name."
"And it will come when I put on the laurel," I say.
She coos. "Aren't you just the most precocious of creatures? Yet you came anyway."
"Could I have refused?"
"No, not really."
"There is an alternative to nepoticide," I say.
"No, I don't think there is. And you're not technically my nephew anyway."
I glance at Ajax. "From what I hear, the position is taken." She laughs at my boldness.
"I wished you no ill. But Ajax did what he did for me, because he guards my heart's delight. You see, I will sit on the morning chair. I will become sovereign. I will establish an empire. First there was Loon, then there was Grimace. Much as I love you, darling, my destiny will not be denied, not by those sneaky Moonies, not by Darrow or his piglet wife, not by you. But by all means, beg."
"I'd rather not."
"Then shall we proceed with your assassination?"
She motions for the white. I hold up a hand for her to stop. The crowd whispers behind us. The legions shift anxiously. Ajax can barely wait another moment for my blood. With a smile made especially for Atalantia, I bend a knee. Ajax stiffens and takes a half step forward before remembering how many watch. "All this I did for you," I say, playing to her vanity. Atalantia laughs.
"Oh, Jove, it is begging, then." She looks away. "How vile."
"All this I did for you," I repeat. Her eyes become interested. This fits her understanding of the world. "When you looked at me on the Anihilo, you saw the boy who used to run with Ajax through the Palatine. All I've wanted since my return is to be a man in your eyes." Her suspicion heightens. "I don't want to be the sovereign," I say with all honesty. "I have no desire for it, no claim on it. It was never meant to be hereditary.
It was meant to go to the strongest, and if I tried to take it from you, it would tear gold apart.
Her gold gauntlets clinked together. You apart, at any rate.
I did not beat Darrow. You did. I just pushed the blade home.
I glance at the gold families behind her, ignoring Ajax.
The carrion birds circle us both. They seek division between us, because it feeds their own delusions of ascendance. We must show them unity.
Her eyes narrow.
What are you proposing? That Grimace and Loon become indivisible, once and for all.
Her lips curl into a wary smile. She doesn't even glance back at Ajax.
Formally? You are feared. I am loved. What better marriage could one hope for?
I ask. To save Heliopolis, I had to undermine her. To undermine her, I made an enemy of her and validated her suspicions and the poison Ajax and the Carthii have likely been putting in her ear. I do not love her, as my parents loved each other, but duty outweighs my heart. This is why I could not look Kalindora in the eye. I knew I would remember how she brought me the Praetorians in the desert, how she helped me when my face was a tattered ruin, but as she left me to the storm to save herself, so I must leave her behind.
Two can be a very awkward number, Atalantia says carefully.
Not so long as all know who kneels.
What a matchmaker you've become. Rim and Cor, Loon and Grimace.
She ponders the idea.
When the old milk bat sets the crown on your head, don't take my hand.
That's my answer, and her signal to whatever sniper lurks in the buildings. Whether it is death or life, I will not know until it has happened. There are cheers of relief as we turn together toward the crowd, but the cheers are far too premature. Neither Ajax nor Atlas know what has happened, but down below, Roan and Glirastes wait for the answer. The white steps forward, her dark face as ancient as her tattered robes. Milky eyes watch me with inhuman distance. Her hands hold a green laurel crown. My heart thuds in my chest, forcing my vision into a tunnel.
Son of Luna!
I barely hear her voice for the blood in my ears.
Today you wear purple, as did the Etruscan kings of old. You join them in history. You join the men who broke the empire of the rising sun, the women who dashed the Atlantic Alliance into the sea. You are a conqueror. Accept this laurel as our proclamation of your glory.
She sets the laurel on my head. Atalantia smiles beside me. I lift my right hand, open as is the way, to grip invisible destiny. Atalantia does not seize it.
Per aspera, I say.
Ad astra, roars the human sea of Heliopolis.
No bullet finds me.
Celebrate, my love, Atalantia whispers, for you have lived before death. In the immortal words of Plautus, let us celebrate the occasion with wine and sweet words.
The triumph festivities extend well into the evening. The sounds of rooftop parties and the debauched celebrations of the core golds within the mound itself lap at me as I stand with a cup of wine atop the stairs and watch the brown and red crews sweep the flowers from the Via Triumphia. I smell roses as Atalantia joins me from behind. Her gold gauntlet squeezes my shoulder.
Bored of the sycophants already, my love? She asks.
On her neck, Hypatia stirs to eye me before returning to her slumber. My grey Praetorians in the shadows watch her obsidian ash guard with their hands on their rifles. We have not yet shared news of our pending union. Considering how much wine Ajax has downed, it would be violent timing. As a boy, I always wondered how you put up with them, I say.
And as a man?
I wonder how you put up with them.
You would do wise to make friends. Many have spent their years climbing the ladders to heights upon which they might share wine with a man like the heir of Selenius. If you spurn them, they will hate you.
Let them hate me, provided they respect my conduct.
I want to show you something.
She extends a hand. I glance at my Praetorians.
I've held your life in my palm before. I haven't squeezed yet.
She smiles innocently.
Don't you trust me, my love?
I nod to my guards. Tell Rome to enjoy himself. I am with the dictator.
Atalantia's shuttle flies us over the desert. As we ascend, I catch sight of two lines of impaled bodies that lead out of the city and into the desert.
Reds and golds, Atalantia says. It stretches to the sea they stirred. The others can work or join the line.
To react would be to lose respect in her eyes. To contradict would be to make her doubt my acceptance of her supremacy. So I remain silent. Her shuttle takes us to the Anihilo. The triumph has spread to its halls. Soldiers toast one another in mess halls and give proclamations that soon the Legion Eagles will fly over Luna again. Atalantia leads me along by my hand. Her meditation chamber has changed since my arrival. Gone is the garden, replaced by sleek black walls and a white floor. The mural of our family still hangs on the wall. The viewport looks down on drowned Tyche. The waters have receded, but the city is in ruins. Only the water colossus stands equal to its former glory. Atalantia brings me before the viewport.
This is our victory, she says. 3 days from now, I would like for you to break ground and lead the restoration of Tyche personally. Glerastes will be your master maker. You will not want for funds. I intend to deliver most of your inheritance from my own coffers.
Her largesse surprises me.
All the worlds will see that what the slave king destroys, the heir of Selenius will rebuild greater than before.
I examine her face for some sign of deception and find none, just a deep feline satisfaction.
Why? I ask.
Because my husband must be loved.
She turns her body to me. Her gold gauntlet strokes my burn and slides to cup my head. Her eyes flutter. Her tongue wets her lips as she pulls my mouth to hers. Her teeth glide along my bottom lip, nipping tenderly. She pulls back, sees something in my eyes to her satisfaction, and then crushes my mouth against hers in hunger. Her tongue probes mine, and the heat of her body presses against me as a gauntlet strokes my groin. My blood quickens in guilt. I feel light and heavy as my hands explore the taut muscles of her back, sliding down and down and down. I pull away. Ajax is a puppy. She puts a finger to my lips as I try to protest. On your back, love. I find myself obeying, watching in lust, as she removes her jacket and clothes, till she wears nothing but the snake and the gold gauntlets. She cuts off my pants with a small blade that emerges from a finger of the gauntlets. She takes me in her mouth, and I shudder in pleasure as she crawls up my body to put me inside her. She gives a little gasp, her mouth hovering just above mine, and then a devilish smile grows on her lips as she begins to grind back and forth between the drowned city and the mural of our dead family.
Chapter 90. Lysander, the Love Knight.
Glerastes has given Kalindora a villa by the sea in which to die. If any doubted the honour of the Love Knight, one need only look at the quantity and worth of those friends who gathered to see her once more before she passes from this world. Despite the triumph, the air is sombre, I have felt dirty since I awoke with Atalantia, but not too dirty to reject her morning advances. Kalindora's room is littered with tokens of affection, including 2 golden gauntlets from Atalantia, the same gauntlets she wore when we had sex in her meditation room just hours before. A patio ambles down to the waterline, where blue crabs skitter in the surf. It smells not at all like death. Kalindora lies on a humble bed. There are no servants in the room, nor any sign of the immense wealth she inherited as the last eligible member of House Sun. She looks up at me with a wan smile as she sees the flowers I've brought.
"Where did you find Himanthus?" she whispers.
"Glerastes knew of a hothouse in Naran that carried them," I say, wondering if, even after showering, I still smell of Atalantia.
"Of course you remembered."
I hold them close so she can smell them.
"Like home," she says with closed eyes. "Put them by the bed for me."
She nods to the door.
"Are they all still swarming?"
"About 100 or so," I say of the well-wishers in the courtyard. "There's some good ones in there. Rhone came."
"I saw him. You gave him the ducks."
"Yes."
"No one deserves it more. He will guard you well. I only wish I did not have to leave."
She looks so weak. Her remaining arm is wrapped in bandages. After Darrow's savagery, it is a wonder she did not lose it. His poison has leached the colour from her face. She is so pale. To remember her in the Palatine, young and so full of promise, and to see her now, it is almost too much. She was the future. Now she will be the past. It isn't right that she dies and all the sycophants and monsters get to live.
"Don't look at me like that," she says.
"Like what?" Her face tightens.
"I should say congratulations on your betrothal, I think."
"It is a political affair, nothing more."
"You think so?"
She knows. I feel wicked looking down at her. I should have left the triumph. Come here instead. Her eyelashes flutter in pain as a spasm racks the left side of her face. A bit of drool works its way down her chin. I dab it off with my cloak.
"Has Ajax called you out yet?"
"Not yet."
"He will."
"He won't risk Atalantia's displeasure."
"He will. Love may give one wings, but everything burns when it flies too close to the sun."
She looks down at the sheets that cover her dying body.
"It's funny. You always promise yourself you won't become a cliché. You won't be the person who yammers about their school years with old friends, trying to relive the glory. Then you do. You won't be the soldier who doesn't bother learning the names of the fresh troops because they won't be there tomorrow. Then you are. You won't give last breath confessions. Then you must."
Her smile disappears.
"Sit down."
I take the stool at her bedside.
"There are things you must know."
She looks at the door and takes a small jammer from under her sheets. Her fingers suffer nerve damage and fumble with the controls, so I must help her. The noise outside the room disappears, and the sound of the sea can be heard no more.
"I have known Atalantia all my life," she says slowly. "I've seen her as a courtier and a soldier. She has always had something missing. She was here before you."
She looks at the gauntlets.
"Despite what I did, bringing the Praetorians for you, she held my hand and confessed that she believes you're her missing piece."
For a moment I don't think she'll continue. Then with a sigh she forges on.
"Those were the happiest days for her, you know. when Octavia would let you alone from your lessons, and Atalantia would take you to Hyperion. She does love you, in her way. She thought you were the saddest little boy. We all did.
She touches my knee.
Don't take it as a slight. You saw too much to ever truly be a child. You never had a chance to be one, not really. And neither did she. Octavia was hard on her. She was hard on us all.
She coughs, and blood flecks her lips. She waits as I wipe it away.
She was like a poison.
I've never heard her utter so much as a single word against my grandmother. Octavia was a hard woman, but she made us what we are.
She poisoned us.
She was our sovereign.
Sovereign,
she spits the word.
All my life I've served. Octavia, then Magnus, then Atalantia. Everyone sits on that stool and tells me I did it with such honour, and every time I hear it, I want to tear their tongues out.
She looks out at the sunlight as if it were the enemy.
If you regret you are evil, it is still evil. I've killed old men in their beds, children under the feet of their own horses, mothers who begged me to spare their unborn. All because I was a stupid girl who thought her father looked beautiful in his armour. When he retired, I begged to take his oath to my sovereign. He wept that day. I never knew why till after he died. I thought his oath gave him purpose. He was too honourable to say it imprisoned him. On the day he found freedom, he saw his daughter enslaved.
She swallows, reliving the horrors she's done in my family's name.
I only wanted to be useful.
I don't know what to say. Her voice softens.
Get them while they're young, she told Magnus once. Get them while they're young. Then you've got them forever. Honour, duty, it's all a lie. By the time you know better, you're too dirty to get out. Octavia poisoned me. She made me fear to be alone so much that I believed only the darkness would want me.
Her hand trembles upward to touch my face.
Somehow, she didn't poison you.
Her fingers feel right against my cheek. Not electric, like Atalantia's, not rank with guilt, but like they've been missing all my life. I want them to stay forever. I feel safe here. Her touch is not maternal, nor is it hungry, but at this moment I realize she does not see me as boy any longer, but as someone who understands the world as she does. It is already too late.
You were always good. You still are. They all thought you were dead, but I didn't. Say what you will of Virginia. She wouldn't let Darrow kill a boy. Sometimes, when I was in a shuttle and all I could hear were the engines, I would think of you. I would see you off, somewhere by the sea, living a true life. Falling in love, maybe.
Her fingers leave my face.
When you stepped onto the Anihilo, it broke my heart.
Why should me coming home break your heart? I ask. This is my family. She stares at the door, forgetting me and the sea.
I have to tell you something. Something that will make you hate me. Something I know will make you do what has to be done. But I'm afraid.
I take her hand and surprise her by kissing it. Nothing you can say will make me hate you. She swallows.
Your mother.
I go cold. What about my mother?
She was a reformer. Did you know that?
No. Did I? Do I?
No, of course you didn't. She saw what Octavia was, how her grip was squeezing tighter and tighter till it would choke our world. She thought the burning of Rhea was an abomination, and she saw how slowly her mother was trying to corrupt you. So, with Romulus's father, Rivas, and Nero Augustus, she planned a coup. Lysander, it wasn't outriders or terrorists who killed your mother. It was Octavia who gave the order.
How do you...
Because Atalantia and I planted the bomb on their shuttle.
I stare at her, unable to comprehend.
You and Atalantia?
Yes.
You were her closest friends.
Yes, though it broke my heart. I did as my sovereign commanded.
My hand slips away from hers. The world shrinks to a very small, very quiet place, as memories and all their weight fall upon me. All the times I sat with my grandmother, dined with her, flew with her, tried to impress her, and she sat there, the old crone, pretending she didn't send my father and my mother smouldering into the sea. All the times Atalantia took me to Heliopolis, held my hand at the opera, squeezed me between her sweating legs. A dark glass slides over the world. I will never be the same.
Why can I not remember my mother's face? I ask.
Do you remember a chair?
I say nothing.
Octavia had many monstrous machines, but none so cruel as the chair. She called it Pandemonium. With it she could pervert the mind. When she discovered Anastasia's treason, she swore she would erase her from history. She did not succeed in that, but she did steal her from you, Lysander. After your mother died, you were inconsolable. She was a good mother. She loved you more than anything in the world. Octavia grew jealous. After 2 weeks in the chair, her work was done, and you didn't cry any more.
I wish I did not believe it, but I do. What else could erase the face of a mother from the memory of her only son? I feel myself struggling to breathe. It was not enough to rob me of my childhood, not enough to rob me of my parents. She robbed me of the one thing that is mine, the one thing that no one should ever be able to take away.
Did Aja know?
No. She nearly broke her oath to Octavia over it. Atalantia didn't bat an eye. She is a monster. Yet I swore an oath to serve Magnus, and when he found he was dying, he made me swear an oath to her.
Kalindora swallows.
I am a monster. I know that. I turned my back on the covenants of the Olympics, on my own heart. But I will not die a monster. I won't let her devour you. She cannot sit upon the mourning chair. She must not. She would burn the worlds so long as the ashes kneel.
I stand, unable to look at Kalindora.
I wasn't strong enough to make a stand. But when you came back, I knew it was time. That is why I called the Praetorians.
She reaches for my hand.
You are the sovereign, the last heir of Selenius, the last hope of gold. And you are good. What are the chances you can repair what Darrow and Octavia broke? Make all this horror be for something. Fix what is broken in our people, Lysander. I know it won't be easy, and I am sorry I cannot be there to help you. Keep Rhone and Atlas close. He loved your father and mother too much for Octavia to ever tell him the truth. So she sent him to the Kuiper, thinking he would never return. He will protect you with his life.
I can't take any more. I head for the door.
Do your duty, she says. Do your duty. or the world will burn.
I leave the room, a hollow avatar of myself, and find Atalantia smiling at me from amidst the golds, waiting to say farewell to the hero. She motions me to come to her, and I do. I smile and laugh beside my lover, the killer of my mother. And later that night, as I sit across from her at supper, as she gloats over the wreck her creatures have made of the Republic Senate and Darrow's heart, we receive word that Kalindora has died. We attend the spectacle of her son burial on the Anihilo, the honour guard of Praetorians, led by white ceremonial virgins, carries her casket to a burial gun set in the main hangar, which fires her toward the sun. Roan stands at attention. Atalantia weeps. Atlas does not speak. Ajax wavers in rage, almost too drunk to stand as he glares at me with such hatred. It is a wonder he does not call me out then and there, as Atalantia gives the benediction with glassy eyes. That night she sends for me. I have no choice but to go. I find her weeping in her meditation chamber. I console her, and we stare at the mural of our family, at the blurred face of my mother, as Atalantia kisses my neck and whispers in my ear for me to take her pain away and take her to bed. When she is done with me, she turns over to sleep, and I lie there, staring at the ceiling, feeling dead inside.
Chapter 91. Virginia. Salvation or Vengeance. Deja Thoris, this is Phobos' command. Your approach vector is prime. Welcome home, our sovereign. There is a small vault in my heart where certain words are guarded like fragile artifacts. Family, home, love, son, husband, brother. My enemies have cracked the vault open, ransacked it, and defecated on its floor. Home. I don't recognize that word anymore. It has been violated. I have been violated. A corner of my heart was always reserved for my twin, despite all his failings. Now the existence of Lilith's abomination eats at me. The abomination has Severo. Mercury has fallen. My husband is still missing with Cassius, and I have fled to Mars. It was the only choice. Our failure to come together until too late robbed us of any alternatives. I left Severo and Clown and Pebble. I left my husband to die. It was Cassius Cavax sent for him. The man was found in his deep space corvette. The communications equipment had been destroyed, and his ship barely managed to limp back to Mars. The details of his escape from his rim imprisonment are fuzzy at best, but it seems he was spared from execution by one of Romulus's sons. He was secluded in a private estate on Europa, to be released when the war ended. He broke out and stole his ship back to escape. After delivering the news to Cavax, he offered his service to the Republic. I never thought I'd hear that in all my life. I watch out the viewport of the Deja Thoris as 40 nimble corvettes form an honor lotus before our fleet and head back to the outer picket line. I don't deserve it. While Cassius plunged into the heart of the enemy for Darrow with only a small strike team, I had an armada and I ran away. It was the right choice, but those are the ones that age you. Ahead, the blue iron tails of our honor guard wait. 30 crimson ecliptic guard torch ships guide us towards Mars's defensive sphere. First through roving patrols, then a 10,000-meter gulf followed by thickets of minefields and light cannon array, then the hunting grounds for attack squadrons of destroyers and torch ships, and finally into the realm of the apex predators, the defense platforms, the dreadnoughts, and their battle groups. Mars has rallied for its sovereign. The loyal stand ready, ma'am, Holiday says from my shoulder. But will they be enough, Nakamura? She is not used to hearing doubt in my voice, nor do I often allow it to intrude. But I feel a kinship with the commando that has deepened these last days as our shared dream crumbles around us. She took the news of Ephraim's death stoically, but I know it eats at her. Just as I may be free from the abomination's grasp, but I am yet enslaved by the work undone, the enemies unvanquished, the friends unsaved, and the mistakes I made. Could I have gone for Darrow? Or was the Rim waiting to close the trap and pin me against the Ash Armada? As ever, Holiday senses my mood. Mom, I know you'll think you are only 100 meters away. Not gonna lie, that will haunt you sure as a fold against a single comet bluff. But they taught, in the Ludus, the surest path between two points ain't always the shortest. I turn on her. You think there's a chance we'll get Severo back? She gives me a grim smile. It's been done before. Victra found my son. I lost her husband. No amount of calculus will fix that arithmetic. Yet Victra did not sail on Luna. She respected your orders. She gives a curt nod out the viewport where Mars's moons are coming into sight. I step forward. The full might of the Julii fleet roves around the pincushion city moon of Phobos and the battle moon of Deimos. The Pandora's comforting mass is sorely missed, but Victra's personal fleet is larger even than my own. With her lost child and Severo in captivity, I feared she would run wild. Instead, her trade armada readies for war. Light flares on the Julii Sun dockyard halo as we pass. Hundreds of new ships teem with expedited industry as the workers and automatons race against the doomsday clock. And then we are past the dockyard, and the planet itself looms before us. On Mars, I was born and rode horses at Ishtar. On Mars, my eldest brother bled to death on the Aegean cobbles before Carnus Albalona. And my mother jumped off a cliff. My father and my best friend were killed by my twin. On Mars, I met my husband. But only my son waits below. It seems a lifetime ago that Darrow led my father's reign against our planet. I watched the friction trails bloom from this very bridge. How simple the world seemed then in the tunnel of youth. Could I have really been only 19? Can it be wrong to feel nostalgic for a day of blood? Or was it the innocence I miss, before we truly knew what turned the world? The melancholy is scored away by wrath, as the night side of the planet comes into view. Cimmeria is cloaked in darkness. The obsidian I allowed to seize the continent in hopes they would call it home and defend it with their lives have ravaged it instead. The central cities of Nike, Phoenicia, and Olympia are dark. I believed in the obsidians. I believed in Sephi. I was too optimistic. It only took a single man to topple her reign and unleash her people. Now the obsidian army and fleet are gone, having disappeared mysteriously after Kieran gave Volga over to the father of Ragnar. It seems all this Volsung Far wanted was Sephi's army and only half her stores of helium. The rest they left abandoned in containers on the tarmacs as casually as if the containers were filled with surplus dining utensils. What does Nars mean to you, Nakamura? I ask. The Terran hesitates. Hope. And you, my liege? War. I turn on a heel for the hangar. As pit crews prepare Pride 2 for disembarkation, Kavak sits on the hangar floor. He stares out at Mars floating on the other side of the pulse field. Sophocles spools in his lap, watching his master with concern. I set a hand on Kavak's shoulder as I approach. He closes his eyes in a moment of warmth, then looks back at the planet. Daxo loved Mars because she never pretended to be a maiden, he says. The beautiful Scarred, he called her, I reply. the beautiful scarred. Kavax loses himself for a moment in the echo. He loved South Pacifica, but he was born here, in Zephyria, where I was born. When he was as high as my knee, I took him as my father once took me, through the heartwood, and I showed him the tree that grew from the seed of my father's heart, and his before him. I showed him where mine would be planted, where his would be planted beside his brother's. His voice trails away. Kavax was not able to recover Daxo's body. The Vox cremated the slain senators and mixed them into the sewers so they could not be collected by their kin and brought back to Mars. "Pardon me," he says, collecting himself. "Sometimes the indignity is more than I can bear." Kavax is no longer the indestructible man who helped raise me. His decline started with Volga's grievous wound to his side, then Thraxa going missing, and finally Daxo's remains floating through the sewers of a moon Kavax hated. He despairs he will lose his remaining daughters, his wife, and his planet. He looks up at me with wet eyes. "Must it be here?" he asks. "It must." I offer a hand to help him rise. With a heavy sigh, the weary family man kisses his pet on the brow, takes my hand, rises, and transforms once more into my father's enforcer, the warrior giant of House Telemannus. Even I feel inclined to shiver, but it is a tragedy to see any man sacrifice his nature for his vocation, much less a man I love so much. To be what we need, what I need, he must go to war again. All his life he waited to pass the reins to his children. Now so few are left. It is not how he thought it would be, but he endures. He puts an arm around my shoulders. "There is an evil in us, as there is good, but we do not regret our good as we do our evil. So we know what we are, my daughter. We know what we are." His voice fades, his conviction exhausted. So I pull him closer. "We know what we are," I reply. He hears the certainty in my voice and straightens to his full height and pulls away. "When your father would return to Mars, he would run the Iron Circle to prove who owned the planet." I am not my father. Not in all ways. That's been proved. But sometimes you need to show a little fang. The Iron Circle is an old custom popularized by Selenius. To prove the depth of his dominion over a planet or moon, he would fly his shuttle without escort in a ring around it upon arrival, no matter the political tensions or adversaries at large on it. Take your shot. It was his fucking planet. The custom has gotten quite a few powerful men killed. Sometimes people just can't resist tossing a stone at Goliath and fell out of practice with most households. To do it now, in the wake of the violence Mars has seen, despite the threats at large, is saying no more and no less to the world than "look how big my cock is." With the main shuttle Pride One in the hands of the Abomination, we leave the hangar of the Deja Thoris in Pride Two. The war shuttle bucks as it descends through atmosphere without its escort of ripwings. Niobe's Fox One joins us starboard. As we perform the Iron Circle, I sit, rolling my fingers along the rim of my husband's ring. Cassius sent it back to him, and Darrow gave it to me. He gave everything to me he could. I wish I could let him know it was enough. Let Cassius have found him. Let me slide into bed with him one last time. Let me feel his warmth again. I need him more now than ever. Mars needs him. All the ships and gun batteries in the world don't make Mars seem safe without the Reaper. My officers in the cabin do their best not to look nervous as we pass over the Amazonian Sea toward war-torn Cimmeria to complete the circle. What will I say to my son when I see him? Pax is neither stupid nor helpless, especially not with Electra at his side. He would not have woken up every day, praying it would finally be the day his mother would save him and make everything right in the world again. No, He would use game theory. He would work the models in his mind until he saw the reasons, the permutations, the tectonic plates in motion. Then he would scheme a way to help me as much as he could. I wonder if Pax realizes yet that I raised him to be as much an ally as a son, and if he understands my guilt over that. If he knows, could he still grasp how losing him was like losing a limb? How my love for him goes beyond logic, beyond explanation? Virginia, Kavax whispers at the viewport. Look, I can't muster the energy. Either someone shoots at us or doesn't, I say. The Iron Circle was your idea. Just look. Holiday tries to join Kavax at the viewport. When he won't move, she takes the next viewport down and shatters my officer's grim mood with a throaty laugh. Mom, you'll want to see this. Frowning, I slide open my viewport shade and see a line of fire racing across the dark landscape east of Nike, another flaring west of Phoenicia, and yet another southeast of Olympia itself. To be so visible at this height, the lines must nearly be 100 kilometers long. As I watch, the lines of fire curve into the shape of a sling blade. Mars endures. Despite the recent violence, no surface fire licks upward at my ship during its passage around the planet. Eve and I didn't believe we'd complete the Iron Circle without incident. The mood of the officers has changed. The holocans in the back of the shuttle mumble with beating drums and singing crowds in cities all across Mars. In my shame, it is not the response I would have expected. Mars's zealotry has always been reserved for my husband and his first wife. Kavax sits by the door, tapping his heels, eager to set foot on his home soil again. Holiday watches the holos with a look of love for the planet as it hails Lionheart and the Republic. Clouds embrace the shuttle, and when they pull back, we see the Val Marineris gashing the world with its glittering towers and the glowing green parks and forests that sprawl along the cityscape and crawl up its towering walls. Millions of civilians line the rim of the Great Canyon. Hundreds of thousands of new recruits pour onto the grounds outside what was once my institute, but is now the Pegasus Legion barracks. As we approach Aegea, the grounds become lost beneath the shifting tides of humanity that gather in the parks and courtyards and main avenues. The Via Triumphia is as clogged as it was on Mars's first liberation day. They are all holding something red above their heads. My shuttle sets down between the Republic's victory obelisks that lead the way to the Lion Stairs. The sounds of the sea humanity that fill the courtyard wash against the shuttle. I see now what they hold above their heads. Their millions of clenched fists are dipped in red. A great murmur seeps through the crowd as I descend the plank with Kavax and Holiday at my side. They grow silent enough I can hear my boots on the metal plank and then on the marble as I cross the courtyards of victories to the Lion Steps. Niobe joins us along with the Centurions of Pegasus Legion, Loyalist Skyhall and House Naval Captains, and the remaining three widows of Arcos. The drums along the courtyard boom from the labor of red tribal drummers. I ascend the steps quickly when I see my boy waiting at the top of them. He is real. He is alive, just 10 meters away. It is as if he has walked through a doorway and come out not as a man, but finally the blueprint of the man he will one day be. He's a hand taller, his cheeks shrunken, new scars on his face. But the real change is in his eyes. The look of childish wonder is gone forever. Now they hold the dullness that marks the passage into wisdom. I wish I could wrap my boy in my arms and hold him until he became part of me again. I would garland him with kisses and apologies and promises. But we are at war, and I am the sovereign, so the mother must wait her turn. Kavax sees my distress and breaks from the procession to scoop my son up in his arms with a madman's laugh. He perches him on his shoulder and crows about the boy who killed a torch ship. I approach the Arch-Governor. My husband's brother smiles up at me, as charismatic as Darrow, but without even a hint of his brother's violent temperament. Kieran was always demure in private and popular with the crowds. It looks right to see him with the Sword of the Rising on his hip. Behind him stand the praetors of the Martian legions, the imperators of the Ecliptic Guard, and the old sons of Ares commanders, all battle-hardened and clever, if a far cry from those we lost on Mercury. Kieran clears his throat. "My sovereign," his voice floats over the crowd. "Luna has fallen. The Senate is dissolved. The Arch-Governors hold planetary imperium. According to the new compact of the Republic, in this time of peril, I exercise my power to grant total imperium to my sovereign." He pulls the Sword of the Rising from its sheath. It is the battered sling blade of the slave once known as L17L6363, his brother, the very tool Darrow used in the mine of Lycos. Kieran passes it to me. It is heavier than I expected a red could wield. I turn to the crowd beyond the obelisks and thrust the blade in the air. "Hail Libertas," I bellow. "Hail Reaper," echoes the crowd. After I have received my debrief, I find Pack sitting with Holiday in the garden where my brother killed my father 12 years before. The blood has been washed from the stone, but I still see it there. Whatever Pax has told Holiday has her in tears. He presses something into her hand, and she surprises me by kissing his forehead. She salutes as she passes me. Scampering around the edge of the garden, Sophocles salutes her departure with a bark and weaves through my son's legs in delight to see him again. My old memories of the garden disappear as my boy spots me. I feared he would greet me as I've seen him greet his father, with that cold, scolding remove. But my fears were unfounded. All pretense fails between us and we crash together in an embrace. That hollow his absence has made in me is filled. I feel as whole, as warm, as loved, and proud as I did the day I first held him in my arms. How many times did my willpower almost break? How many times did I let myself imagine what sinister designs my enemies had in store for him? He has survived. As I pull back from him, I see his father's anger in his eyes, his mother's patience, his own animated curiosity. But he has changed. The sounds of training razors clack through the seaside courtyard at Hippolyte. Victra curses loudly, then barks, "Again!" Pax sees me hesitate to pass through the fighter's arch. I'm afraid to see my old friend. He takes my hand and steers me clear of the training yard, and together we approach the burial place of Ulysses. Grass has begun to grow over the small mound. The burial stone is wet with the morning rain. This could have been my son. Pax knows my mind and steps closer to me. "You were right about Lyria of Largolos," he says. "She did have virtue. Without her and Volga, it seems Victra would have been lost. I would like to see her again. Her brother was evacuated by the..." "He's on the Reynard. I know. I've sent her away." I look at him without surprise. "Where to?" "After Ragnar's daughter, in a manner." "I don't understand. She's just a girl." He pauses. "Not anymore." We look back to the grave, guilty for speaking over it. Severo told me he was having a girl. It seems Victra was waiting to surprise even him. A boy, at last. A chance to make up for his own father's absence. "Mother wanted to give him a son death," Electra says. Always fleet of foot, she has grown quieter. I didn't hear her approach. Like Pax, she's grown since I last saw her. But she knew father would want him to visit when he gets back. "Electra, thank you for taking care of my son," I say. Her narrow eyes flick to him. "That's his story? No one likes liars, Pax." They flick back to me. They were always hard, but not like they are now. I can see that now all she wants is to grow up so she can kill. It's no longer cute. Whatever the obsidian were feeding you worked. Look how tall you are. She shrugs. Maybe you're just smaller. She bows slightly for her sovereign, then walks away. Pax watches her go with a worried expression. She doesn't like waiting, Pax says. I glance toward the training courtyard. That makes two of us. Wait here. I find Victra in the center of the courtyard, facing down three of her best knights. I silence my datapad before entering. Even at her peak, three prime opponents would have been one too many. Sweat lathers muscular arms swollen with welts. She trains like a woman possessed. Already the curves of motherhood burn away. Practice razors whisper through the air as I walk in. A clutch of 60 peerless stiffen and bow at my arrival. I whisper hello to Victra's youngest daughter, Celine, and the middle child, Calypso. When they hug me, I see their hands are bandaged from training. Sons of Ares practice martial arts along with a bluff on Victra's estate. Both parts of House Julii and Barker are preparing for total war. In the square, Victra eliminates one of the knights with a neat thrust to his neck, and then receives a sideways slash to her shin and another to her temple from the fastest of the three. The head strike is a killing blow. Blood trickles down Victra's face. She stumbles, growls, returns to the center of the circle and shouts for them to go again. The knights stop and bow when they see me. Victra casts me an annoyed glance and stalks over to a towel to wipe the blood off her face. I join her there. Does Mars ride for Luna, my sovereign? She asks. You know we can't yet. Then what do you want? Just to speak with. And of what should we speak? Of how they nailed my son to a tree? Of how our Skamani came like fucking monsters out of the ether? Of how you could have saved Darrow but didn't? Victra. Or maybe of how my husband is being tortured by that abomination while you run back home to lick your wounds. She glares down at me. You might think I obeyed your orders, that I moulder here out of fidelity to your leadership. No, I am here because without reinforcements my fleet would be massacred by the Vox, much less if we ran afoul the Corps. She sticks a finger in my chest. You abandon my husband. Our enemies move uncontested. So, unless Mars is riding for Luna right now, fuck off. She turns back to her practice. The knights look away as I strip off my jacket and unbutton my tunic to my compression bra. Victra, she turns. Her eyes trace the divots Lilith's hatchet left on my stomach and neck and the several hundred punctures the mob gave me on my flanks and arms, and a tension releases from her shoulders. Her love and hate are made of the same passion. I tried, I whisper. Truly. Her eyes search each one of the scars. I now have more than she does. Her heavy hand reaches to clutch my shoulder, and then the bigger woman pulls our foreheads together. If we cannot engineer salvation for our men, then vengeance will suffice, Victra says. I nod against her. My husband would have had it no other way. No matter what they say, Darrow is not dead. He endured for me and I did not arrive. I will endure now until he does. Victra will have her wrath till her dying breath. I will have my hope. I will make our family whole again. There's a stirring in the courtyard from the knights. A defense pulse shield warps the air of Hippolyte, and Pax rushes into the courtyard with his datapad in hand. By the look on his face, I know what it is. Earth has fallen, I whisper. Already, Victra snarls. To whom, I ask. Rim, or... Both, he whispers distantly. Cassius was right. Loon has bridged the divide.
Chapter 92. Lysander. Graveyard of Tyrants. Are you certain you want me to leave you alone out here?
Roan's eyes search the warped horizon of the Ladan. Pytha stands behind him before my personal shuttle. Until the wedding, Ajax will look for any opportunity. Ajax is on Earth. It must be done. But Dominus, he looks again at the feast. In the middle of the desert, upon a great dune, two broad couches of purple silk and raw nebula wood lie on either side of a long table, weighed down by a feast to feed 20. Are you certain this is safe? I don't believe my guest would respect safe. Are you certain he will come? I look out at the desert. The better question is, if he is even real. What do you mean? Never you mind. Come back for me in 2 hours, I say. If I'm in more than one piece, collect my remains and fire them into the sun. I hand him a data drop. My will. Glirastes has a copy too. Glirastes, who took the day to scout locations for a new library in Pan, would be furious if he knew that I was out here in the desert instead of overseeing the rebuilding of Tyche. But despite what he thinks, he needn't know all my affairs. After a hesitation, Roan salutes and enters the shuttle. Pytha remains behind. "Do you know what you're doing?" she asks. "He is not a sane man." "Are you afraid of him, Pytha?"
"Yes."
"So is everyone." She understands as she remembers her advice in the fitting bay of the Anihilo, but she does not like it. Soon the shuttle is out of sight. I sit on one of the couches and sip chilled wine. With Kalindora's revelations, my inner world is in shambles. But the strings of oaths, fidelity, and history that conspired to strangle me are cut. I know the rules now, Grandmother. There are none. At last, I feel free. Here in the aftermath of the Battle of Mercury, I sense a great horizon of opportunity. The free legions are broken. Darrow is in flight. Luna is run by a madman. Mars trampled by obsidians. Earth fallen to the rim and the society. That sense of insignificance and guilt I permitted Cassius to instill within me has not disappeared, but remains in the back of my mind as a reminder of the fate one can accept if he lets the mercy of others define him. Darrow's mercy, all those years ago, Cassius's mercy in serving as my protector, Kalindora's last testament, all of it rooted in some vain attempt to rekindle honour they long ago sacrificed for one reason or another. The same honour Lorne preached after painting a legend in blood, the same selfish honour Romulus preserved before abandoning his people at their most dire hour, the same honour that led to my engagement with Atalantia, and let me delude myself into thinking that honour was about personal sacrifice. My grandmother was the most cunning person I ever met. But still, she was wrong. She thought there was no place for honour in the world. I cannot agree completely. It was her cruelty that chipped away at the foundation of her power and poisoned all who served her. It is Atalantia's cruelty which makes me pray to people like her. Is it honourable to kill her for my mother? Honourable to thrust us into civil war? Honourable to fulfil my pledge to submit to her every whim? Honourable to be trapped between her legs night after night, so that gold might have unity? I think not. I think, as with all things, honour is best appreciated in moderation, as is cruelty. After all, there is no crime with a court. The whine of grav boots disturbs my silence. My guest arrives. He is no figment of my imagination. He is real and dreadful. His Martian armour radiates heat in the sun until he steps into the cool provided by the pulse bubble I have prepared. He looks over the table from beneath the horns of his helm.
A mirage of no finer quality has ever graced this wasted tomb to ambition and martial men,
he declares through his helmet.
Libations of Elysian Red, Terran Bordeaux, Mercurian Soletto, with gustatio of raw oysters, wine-steamed sow's udders, candied pecans, olives, azaroles, and medlars and juscelum. A mense prime of walnut and herb-stuffed thrush and paschal bell, garlic venison, honey drizzled wild boar stuffed with dried figs, garum sauce, and do mine eyes deceive me?
His giant helmet inspects the centerpiece.
A hare decorated with the wings of a peacock. No, 'tis but a noble Pegasus, and not to be forgotten, a mense secunde of Looney's iced frise, tactoon, chocolate pecans, and white pudding.
He looks up at me, that metal helmet impassive and dreadful.
Now this is a cena, a feast fit for a conqueror, a gourmand, a student of Apicius himself, and set before such grandeur.
He waves at the desert.
Yes! Yes, I at last am paid the respect I am due.
If I have learned anything, it is that one does not simply summon the Minotaur, I reply. If you would please do me the honor of joining me, I believe we have common interests to discuss. He doffs his helmet and reclines on the couch. His face is that of an evil angel, masculine, suspicious, amused, and tan, from what I assume he considers his vacation in the desert. He peers under the table with mocking eyes.
Gelding or stallion, my good man?
Were you not there when I was tortured? I ask.
I was mocking your union with the Fury, not your time with the Gorgons, he says. How well I know the unlimited depths of her voracious appetites, though I hear Ajax has filled the holes my absence has left. Now you seek to do the same.
He grins.
But yes, I was outside the cave. I waited, listening via my sophisticated drone hardware to the ministrations of the Fear Knight. I confess, I considered striking when you purloined him for your own purposes. Such opportunity seldom presents itself with that most dangerous game. But the show, oh, the show was far too interesting to interrupt. The flight across the desert will be held forever in amber in the hollows of my mind.
He leans forwards, very sincere.
I do apologize for claiming you lacked theatricality. It is always a pleasure to be wrong.
He strokes his purple chest plate. The grapevines of his home in Thessalonica stretch to a horizon gilded with silver sunlight.
Alas, my armor died from that infernal electromagnetic pulse. I have yet to divine why its shielding failed to that device. I have many questions for Glerastes, many questions to which I must have answers.
They can wait. I confess I am surprised to find that you did not go witness the attack on Earth. Most of your quarry were in play.
My path to my quarry runs through this moment, he says. And after the ash rain?
He looks offended.
After a cup of 21 Thessalonican Chianti, one does not rinse one's mouth with sangria. I saw 30 million men in mortal conflict. Oh, my need for violent theatre is quite sated. In any matter, it was a pathetic affair. The Vox fleet gazed lazily from their perch above Luna as Atalantia feigned a retreat and led Earth's fleet straight into a rim attack group. The only thing of interest would have been to see the son of Romulus lead his commandos to the surface to lower the shield generators. What a specimen is he! Perhaps we have a new lead on stage.
Well, I hope you still have room for theatre of a different sort, I say. A great mechanical groan tears the sky, frightening the dishes and the sand of the dune into frantic palpitations. The sound rushes toward us in a flood of decibels, till it seems that the torrent of it will swallow the dune. And then it is overhead, and Apollonius grins. A great mass blocks the sky. Slowly a thin wedge of blue elongates in the darkness, as two vast legs of stone pass through the midday heat. They are but the lowermost extremities of the ancient mass borne aloft by six heavy cargo haulers. The haulers creep across the sky and soon begin to lower their charge. The statue is immense, its face riven by the ravages of desert storms and chipped by the target practice of rising riflemen, sneers at us as if to say, "You think yourself worthy." The stone lips of my first ancestor, Selenius Auloon, curl in contempt as he resumes his rightful place under the sun. The haulers release the towing bonds. The sovereign sways. His stone feet sink into the sand. Dust from his recent grave shudders from his shoulders, nose, and the creases of his robe to form a billowing cloak. When the dust clears, he is still and solemn amongst his mighty fellows. 20 sovereigns stand in the desert to form a circle 10 kilometers in circumference. It is theatre fit for the Minotaur. He claps his hands like a delighted, monstrous child. In each individual one might find vanity, cruelty, pride, all or any of the excesses and deficiencies of the Homo Aureat, I say. But together they stand for something more than their individual parts. Each was a custodian for his or her time, forming a chain of order that guided the human spirit from the dark ages of war through 700 years of expansion and growth. They erred in the end, each small corruption spawning one more evolved and potent, until the natural evolution of that corruption induced decay and torpor, and the death of all empires, aristocracy. In that decay, how could they not expect a new predator to rise?
Darrow, Apollonius smiles, my ultimate prey.
Indeed, it will not be like them. In their shadow I will create something greater, something stronger, something fairer. But it seems nothing fair is made by fairness.
I care nothing for fairness, nor any of your pretentious-minded virtues, he declares with a wave of an armored hand. They are for simpletons. No morality constrains my limitless mind, save my word. You know what I want, little paramour.
Atalantia, Ajax, Atlas, and then Darrow.
And the mind's eye, he says with hunger.
I can give you that, and the rest, but I need something in return. He leans his huge mass back.
Dare I ask, what must I sacrifice upon the altar for my heart's delight?
Nothing. His eyes narrow. You have been mistreated, misunderstood, and betrayed. You have watched me suffer the same. We are alike, Apollonius. It seems a pity that we should be so alone. I lean back and sip my wine. May I ask, do you care at all for rule?
It bores me, as does this conversation.
I know how you will die, Apollonius.
Ooh, much better. How?
You will die the apex predator of this world, having stained it with your legend and the blood of your foes, so that when, in old age, you sit beneath the sycamores of Thessalonica to die, you know you venture into the void not burdened by your conquests, not fettered with responsibility of rule, but light as the ether that binds the heavens, as you drink your Thessalonican red and reminisce of the enemies you cut to their knees. He is enchanted.
And with whom will I reminisce?
The ally who asks for nothing but your blade and cunning mind, who takes the burden of rule from your shoulders and exempts you from fealty, from all oaths, save the one where you gave your word to stand beside him against the worlds. I extend a hand. With a smile he seizes it, in his immense gauntlet. His eyes blaze with excitement.
"To the trembling of the worlds," he whispers.
Together we gaze at the graveyard of tyrants. In the days before the rising, the people of Mercury would come to this place and follow the statue's extended arms, which pointed at midnight to Luna, to remind them where power truly resided. When I found the statues, they lay fallow in the dirt, covered with war machines and blood, their arms pointing in all directions. Now, no longer a bickering mass in a shared grave, they stand together again. They point together toward a small patch of the sky, where at noon a distant sphere, appearing no larger than a small grain of sand, circles the sun. They point to remind my guest and all of Mercury our task is yet unfinished. They point toward Mars.
The End. This is Tim Gerard Reynolds. We hope you have enjoyed this production of Dark Age by Pierce Brown, narrated by John Curlis, Renda Haywood, James Langton, Moira Quirk, and Tim Gerard Reynolds. Recorded books are available wherever audiobooks are sold, including Audible.com, Audiobooks.com, Google Play, Apple iTunes, and in public libraries through RB Digital. Thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.